From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, two former POWs discuss their years in captivity in Hanoi and how they survived repeated torture. Ron Bliss and Ed Meckenbeyer are among the men featured in the new documentary, Return with Honor, about American fighter pilots who were shot down in North Vietnam and held as prisoners of war. The film was made by the same team that made the Academy Award-winning documentary about Maya Lin, the designer of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. Former Prisoners of War, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Oppressive heat blankets much of the eastern half of the country today. Authorities blame the heat for at least 11 deaths in Missouri, Ohio, and Illinois. Utility companies are asking consumers to conserve electricity, saying that demand for air conditioning is straining their systems. Most of those killed by the heat so far have been elderly people who lived in homes without air conditioning. A judge in Tallahassee has struck down Florida's law requiring that the parents of minors be notified before their daughters have abortions. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
The law, which was supposed to have taken effect July 1st, would have required doctors to notify parents if their daughters under age 18 sought abortions. Circuit Judge Terry Lewis delayed enforcement of the law amid a constitutional challenge by abortion providers, doctors, and feminist organizations. Today, Lewis determined that the effect of the law intrudes on a minor's ability to choose whether to terminate a pregnancy. This is the third time in 3 years a Florida judge has blocked the enforcement of a law seeking to limit access to abortion. The issue is a priority of the state's majority Republican legislature, and Florida's Republican Governor Jeb Bush said through a spokesman that he's confident the law will be upheld on appeal to the state's Supreme Court. Cheryl Duvall, NPR News, Miami.
A motel handyman was arraigned today on charges of murdering a young woman in Yosemite National Park in California, and the FBI says he's the prime suspect in the murders of three sightseers near the park earlier this year. FBI agents say Kerry Stainer has confessed to killing and beheading Joey Armstrong, a 26-year-old naturalist at the park. Stainer had nothing to say at his arraignment. The president of Montenegro says he'll give Serbian officials in Belgrade 6 weeks to work on a plan for revising relations between the two republics that form Yugoslavia. If an agreement isn't reached, Montenegro says it may seek independence. Sarah Chase reports.
Teams of experts from the three parties that make up Montenegro's ruling coalition are still finishing up documents that would serve as a blueprint for a new constitutional relationship between Montenegro and Serbia. The Montenegrin government is expected to approve a harmonized version shortly and send it to Belgrade. In an interview with an Austrian journal, Montenegrin President Milo Djukanovic warned that the mood in his republic is swinging against a continued federation with Serbia. He said Belgrade will have 6 weeks to debate and accept Podgorica's proposals, or else he'll launch a referendum on independence. Even politicians who favor continued union with Serbia say Montenegro must obtain autonomous decision-making power on all matters of state importance. Sarah Chase, NPR News, Belgrade.
The Dow Industrials lost 48 points to close at 10,863 in light trading. This is NPR News. President Clinton says a new U.S. trade agreement with Vietnam should be completed very soon, and when it is, the president says it will be a major step forward for the two countries. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
In a statement released by the White House today, President Clinton said he's pleased that his trade representative and the Vietnamese Trade Ministry have reached a tentative agreement allowing Vietnamese goods to enter the United States with the same tariffs as other countries' exports. The agreement would also help U.S. goods gain entry into the Vietnamese market and allow U.S. telecommunications and financial companies to make investments in Vietnam. The president said that the agreement would promote American commercial interests and help the U.S. get the fullest possible accounting of Americans still listed as missing in action from the Vietnam War. President Clinton has not yet visited Vietnam, but White House officials say it is possible he may go there before he leaves office in January 2001. Mara Liasson, NPR News, the White House.
The Senate is preparing to take up a measure that would cut taxes by $792 billion over a 10-year period. It's a measure the president has threatened to veto. The White House and Senate Democrats say the plan is too expensive, and a $500 billion version of it is little better. Jack Lew of the Office of Management and Budget says it's impossible to cut taxes that much, pay for defense and education, and still protect the Medicare and Social Security programs. Republican Senator Phil Graham said the White House argument is dishonest and that the tax cut is actually modest compared with the tax increases and revenue growth during the Clinton administration. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My two guests were fighter pilots flying missions over North Vietnam when they were shot down, captured, and held prisoners of war. They're among the men interviewed in the new documentary, Return with Honor, about the POWs who were released in 1973. The film was made by Frieda Lee Mock and Terry Sanders, who won an Oscar for their documentary about Maya Lin, the designer of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. The North Vietnamese didn't honor the Geneva Conventions regulating the treatment of POWs. They called their captured men war criminals. My guests were among the POWs who were tortured. Ronald Bliss was held prisoner of war for 6.5 years. After his release, he went to law school. He's now a partner in a law firm handling intellectual property and technology. Ed Meckenbeyer spent 6 years as a POW. After returning home, he stayed in the military. Meckenbeyer left active service in 1978 and has since worked for private aerospace companies. He's also a major general in the Air Force Reserve. I asked them each to describe how they bailed out after being shot down, and Ron Bliss answered first.
I had electrical fire in the front part of the aircraft and a lot of gray smoke and a lot of heat, and it just got hotter and hotter. And about 8 seconds after the pop-up, after I'd already pickled off my bombs hot just in case they tried to carry them south for booby traps, I got out. So I imagine it took about a minute and a half to really punch out, but I knew subconsciously at about the 30-second mark that I'd had it.
Ed Meckenbeyer, you say something really extraordinary in the movie Return with Honor. You stayed in the plane. You were dealing with it, and when you bailed out, the plane crashed about 1.5 seconds after you got out.
Yeah, Ron was a single-engine, single-seat airplane that he was flying, so he didn't have the privilege I did of having somebody. I was flying an F-4C Phantom, which had two people in it. I had myself and a pilot systems operator about 6 feet behind me. And a fighter pilot, you're always in control. If you don't think that you're the world's greatest fighter pilot, you aren't. And one of the things about a fighter pilot is you are in control. Mm-hmm. And I can do this. Don't bother me, as I say in the movie. I had a wonderful gentleman, a classmate of Ron's and mine's from the Air Force Academy, Kevin McManus, behind me, and he said, "Ed, I don't think we're going to make it." And that kind of jogged me out of this thing. I can fly out of this. But by then, the airplane was a complete fireball. And when Kevin and I ejected upside down, 620 knots, going down at 45 degrees nose low, we came out of a fireball. There was nothing left of the airplane except these two seats that came out of the bottom of the fireball. And before the parachutes opened, the airplane hit the ground.
What was going through your mind on the way down?
Please don't hit me, because there were lots of people down there shooting at me. I had a 38 caliber pistol, which was full of tracers, which I knew was not a weapon. It was more of a signaling device. And we were coming down into a populated area, and there were just a lot of people down there shooting at us. And you just see the bullets go whipping. Well, you couldn't see them. You could hear them going by, and you look up and see the holes in the canopy above you.
It must be quite a feeling of helplessness.
Complete helplessness, yes.
Ronald Bliss, were you being shot at on the way down, too?
Well, I was unconscious, so I don't know.
You were unconscious?
I went out just below the speed of sound, about Mach 0.93, and that in itself is, as Ed will testify, somewhat of a miracle to survive that. But I woke up on the ground, stripped down to my underwear, lying on a dirt road, judging from the sun, about 2 to 3 hours later, and they marched me to the little village where the fun began after that. So I don't know what happened on the way down. They always tell you to be nice and relaxed so you don't hurt yourself when you land, and I assure you, I was as relaxed as you could be.
Were you conscious long enough to pull the cord and open the parachute?
Well, it's automatic. I squeezed the triggers.
Oh.
I had the canopy off already trying to cool it down because I had a lot of smoke and fire in the cockpit, but that released the back pressure and it got worse. So I said, I was talking to myself. I said, Tampa 4 is punching out. I'll see you when the war's over. And I didn't have any radio. I didn't know it. But I went out. That's the last I remember. I don't remember any of the parachute ride down, but the seat automatically separates from you and the parachute automatically opens. It's wonderful equipment. It worked.
So when you regained consciousness, did you think, good news, I'm alive, bad news, I'm a prisoner of war?
Well, you're so pumped up with adrenaline, you don't think. You just react. But you go into a pre-training mode, if you will, or pre-ejection mode. And I knew where I was. I knew it was not a good situation. I kept trying to get up off the dirt road, and they wouldn't let me. And finally, when I set up and insisted on walking, I reached behind my head and felt this big clot of blood. I had a probably my seat impacted my head on the way out. And now they were trying to take care of me for those few brief moments, but I had a headache that lasted about a week. It was pretty sensational. It's really nice when they're interrogating you for this, that, and the other, and you start off with a throbbing headache.
Ed Meckenbauer, were you taken prisoner of war pretty immediately after landing?
We landed right in the middle of them, and as Ron says, you know, on the way down, they were shooting at us, and you're trying to get rid of your survival radios and get yourself prepared to land. And I landed right on top of a little building and rolled down and presented myself to the Vietnamese completely tied up in my shroud lines. So, yeah, we were completely surrounded by about a cast of 100 immediately upon hitting the ground.
My guests are Ronald Bliss and Ed Meckenbauer, and they were each held over 6 years as prisoners of war in North Vietnam. They're two of the people who are interviewed in the new documentary Return with Honor about Americans who are held prisoner of war in Vietnam. What does your military training tell you to do if you're captured?
Well,
go ahead, counselor.
Ideally, you hold out for a few seconds by giving them name, rank, service number, and date of birth. But that doesn't last long, or you'll be dead before the night is upon you. So what you have to do for interrogation is to make up a plausible story, sound sincere, and frankly, just give them garbage. And you realize, and you're trained this way under the code of conduct, if you have an opportunity to escape, you must take it. Albeit where we were, it was impossible, and that's a long story. But secondly, you never lose faith with your fellow man, and you try to contact him as soon as possible because you're all in the same pot of soup together, and you just need to hang in there.
Mm-hmm. And Ron made reference there loosely to those who are familiar with the American Fighting Man's Code of Conduct, some of the 6 things they tell you to do. But all anybody ever really remembers is name, rank, serial number, and I'll die before I give them anything else. Well, the rest of that sentence or paragraph goes on, I will evade answering further questions to the best of my ability. And there gets to be a point to where what you know is not worth your life. And sometimes it's not worth even serious injury to yourself or to somebody else, particularly if somebody is depending on you in a cell or, you know, in the total POW system. So then exactly as Ron says, you start doing all those things that you're always trained not to do. You lie, you cheat, you steal, you do anything you can, but you don't try to give them anything of use.
What were the first things that happened to you after you were taken captive?
Well, everybody went through an area. Yeah, everybody went through an area we called New Guy Village or Heartbreak Hotel, and it was a very intense area where they were trying to convince you that because they had complete control of your body, you ought to tell them everything you want and be completely cooperative. It was not a very sophisticated intellectual discussion. It was strictly a brute force effort to bring you down to a level to where they thought you would do anything and everything they ask you to do.
And I'd like you each to describe the cells that you were in, or the prisons that you were in. Ron Bliss, would you start?
Well, the first one that Ed mentioned in Heartbreak Hotel, a special part of the Hanoi Hilton where they break you down, was a wooden bedboard with permanent rusty leg irons on it. The room was 3.5 paces wide and 4 paces long, and it was all bricked up. There was a screen over the window and a light bulb, but it was on day and night, and it was filthy. And this is a comment I think I made in the movie, that when you walk into this place, it was built by the French for the Viet Minh, you can hear the screams of over 50 years. It's a very serious place.
And then where did you, where were you taken after that?
Because the fellow that was there at the same time, and I mean that literally, Jack Fellows, the naval officer, lost the use of his arms for about 8 or 9 months because of the Vietnamese rope trick. We were thrown together after, I don't know, I lost track, about 8 or 10 days, and moved to a camp called The Zoo. It's an old French movie colony that they converted to a prison camp. And we were there inside of 2 weeks, and that's where I spent probably half to two-thirds of my total time in captivity, not at one time, but back and forth to the zoo.
Ed Meckenbauer, were you there as well?
Yeah, I spent about 3 years at the zoo, but like Ron, it seemed like about once every year, probably to, in their own mind, make themselves believe that they had disrupted any kind of a communication routine that we had, a communication network we had within the camps. They'd move you around to different places. So over the 6 years, I lived in 8 different places, from downtown in the Wallo prison, the Hanoi Hilton, to the zoo, to another place we called the plantation because it was an old plantation house with a movie studio associated with that. I spent about a year there. Spent about 8 months up on a camp on the Chinese border, another place called Dog Patch, and various other places around town. So they moved you around occasionally.
My guests are Ed Meckenbauer and Ron Bliss, two of the former POWs featured in the new documentary Return with Honor. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Ron Bliss and Ed Meckenbauer, former fighter pilots who were shot down over North Vietnam, captured, and held for about 6 years as prisoners of war. Now, Ron Bliss had mentioned that his cellmate had lost his use of his arms through the Vietnamese rope trick. Now, the rope trick is a word for a specific type of torture that the Vietnamese used. How often were you tortured during your over 6 years of captivity?
Ron, go ahead, and throw in about the Hanoi March, which is a different kind of torture.
Just before I was shot down, Ho Chi Minh and his cronies, we had had a big airstrike on their oil storage plant in Hanoi, and it shattered their confidence, and it shattered their propaganda invincibility. So they marched chained two by two all the existing POWs down through Hanoi and whipped up the crowd to the point where the Vietnamese guards actually lost control of the crowd, and a lot of our people really got worked over very, very heavily. And I still remember, I think it was the London Times commenting that not since Caesar brought Vercingetorix down from Gaul after he captured him had any spectacle so humiliating ever occurred. One thing that happens to you is, generally speaking, at least for the first 3 years of captives, you go through the rope trick. The rope trick is very simple. There are variations on a theme, but it goes like this. They'll manacle your hands behind you. In my case, it was rigid wrist irons. They throw you down on the floor, face down. They put a rope around your elbows, and they put a bamboo pole through the rope, and they just start cranking it all down. The first thing you feel is your wrists may break. Next, your elbows feel like they could come out of the socket, and then your shoulders may come out of the socket, and then you have back problems. And you have trouble breathing. But there are all sorts of tortures other than that. Food deprivation, sleep deprivation. I was under the Cuban interrogation program for a while, and he killed a man next door to me. It took about 3 years for him to die, but I got worked over with a fan belt I was black and blue for about 6 months after that. There are all sorts of things that they can do at their whim.
Now, how much did these torture sessions actually have goals? Did you have a sense that the people torturing you were sadists who were just enjoying the act of torturing somebody? Or were they really determined to get information, and did they seem to believe that they'd be able to get it this way?
I think individually some of them actually thought that, you know, that they could get information like that. There were others who I think just thoroughly enjoyed. In fact, we had one guy we called Psycho. I think he just thoroughly enjoyed the opportunity to physically abuse another person's body. I don't know that after a period of time anybody on the Vietnamese side really ever thought it was going to be effective. And if you resisted, if they didn't get what you wanted, you know, then they'd try something else, or they'd go try somebody else. So then, again, it was up to the individual to do the best he could. And it comes out in the movie as well. We didn't judge if a guy lasted 5 hours or 5 days or 5 months, or if he went the entire period and never did. You just do the best you can, as much, you know, just for your own personal honor, but it's just to make them, next time they get interested in some information or they want some propaganda, they go try somebody else who might be an easier target.
Well, Robles, what kind of questions did they ask you during the torture sessions? What did they want?
Well, there are two reasons for torture. One is for military information, and two is what they call attitude. Now, military is the classical James Cagney or John Wayne. They want to know about ordnance that you were dropping, altitudes you were coming in at, who else was in the flight. And I had a great off-the-cuff smokescreen story that I gave to them that I'm still proud of. But most of the time in captivity, it really wasn't about military information, because realize, after a year or two, anything you know is obsolete.
That's what I was
what
thinking.
What it is, oh, it really is. Well, what they want is they want the proper attitude. They want you to be subservient, they want you to be cowed, and they want you to be pliable and give propaganda, and they will twist you sometimes as long and as hard as you have to so that they think you're in that mode. Secretly, you never are. They can beat you until you pass out, which is always a blessing, because if you're out, you don't hurt. But we've had people, for example, they threw Red McDaniel into my cell after they tortured him for, he thinks, about 2 weeks. He lost consciousness so many times he wasn't sure in one of the purges. But they hung him upside down from the hook, and they put him in a chair for about 3 days, and he couldn't relax. He woke up on the floor one morning as the interrogator walked in, and there was a whole chalk drawing of the cell block on the floor. And he said, "Sir, did I do that?" He says, "Yes." He didn't even remember doing it. He says, "Well, if I did that, it's a lie." And they started all over again. That's the way it went. It was attitude.
Did either of you at any point give in and tell them what they wanted, or pretend to tell them what they wanted and pretend to believe their propaganda?
Yeah, you never, ever act like you believe. You never give them any kind of encouragement. You may say something like, "Yeah, I understand what you're saying." You know, and that was the first level. I mean, do you understand what I'm saying? Yes, I understand. Once they find out that you say, "Yes, I understand," then they say, "Do you believe?" And you'd never believe.
What did they ask you to believe?
Oh, that their fortunes were wonderful, that they had the just cause, and that the Americans were the aggressor in the South, and it was a puppet government, and all the rest of the traditional communist poppycock, that they had a fraternity and a society and a democratic place there. It was just wonderful, and you know, Nirvana and all the rest of that wonderful stuff. And you never wanted to give them the least hint that you were willing to say publicly or believe even privately anything that they were espousing in terms of a political or social philosophy.
So what's the closest each of you came to feeling like you had reached the breaking point? And no matter
me,
what it...
Yeah. There were two or three times, but I remember... Early on, since I was shot down in a Joint Chief of Staff target, they publicized my ID card picture and everything else in the Vietnam Courier, and I didn't know this for months, but it was a big deal. And we were not living too badly under the circumstances, except they were boiling our brains out in this little hot room we were in. But everybody thought, everybody around me, that maybe they were trying to set me up for an early release, which was not going to happen. So after about a 6 or 7 month period, the camp commander of the lump called me in and asked me what I thought about the treatment, and I told him, and he totally lost it. And he made up for lost time over the summer of 67 in a dirty I mean, blazing hot room. It just radiated all night long, and we would sleep on the floor with the mosquitoes eating us, no mosquito net at all, just to get our nose up by the crack under the door, maybe you get one breath of air a night. And they were working us over pretty well physically, and it was a bad time in the war. We knew we weren't doing well in the air war. And at the end of 67, the end of summer of 67, I gave one of my last formal prayers there to myself, and I said, "Dear God, if it's going to be this bad again, just turn out the lights. I don't want to do it." But we never gave in.
Did you ever seriously entertain the idea of suicide?
Yeah, but I don't think I can run fast enough to crush my skull on the cell wall. And every time I shaved, I had a guard there. I couldn't cut my wrist with a razor blade. So really, that's academic. The answer would be I considered it, but not that seriously.
I'm too big a coward. I wouldn't do it.
Well, that's interesting that you say you're too big a coward to do it. But, you know, here you are facing all this torture. So, you know, that's not what a coward wants, is torture.
Oh, no, I mean, it's just that I couldn't stand the sight of my own blood. I might hurt myself. If they're going to hurt me, that's okay. I mean, but I'm not going to add that. I'm not going to help them.
The only way that people really consider suicide, I think, is when they are alone and not in communication right with their fellow man. And as long as you can talk to somebody around you, that gives you such an enormous strength as a human being that you can find a way to carry on. And people will ask you the question, they don't know what else to ask. They'll say, "Well, what made you get through it?" Well, frankly, it's a different answer for each day. Some days were so mm-hmm. bad, you just look at the guard and quietly think to yourself, "Nguyen, you can't kill me today. I'm not going to die." And maybe the next day it's, "I remember my lovely wife and I want to see her again," or the child who's never seen me. But it was not one answer for the whole time.
Mm-hmm. And you got to remember, I mean, I had the privilege of living with Ron Bliss during one of those years.
So, I mean, so if you lived somebody, together for a year.
Oh, yeah, we lived together.
Oh, we
for
did,
a year.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had an apartment.
We had a rock and roll group of four young lieutenants, and just because of three of us had the same date of rank, and my name started with BL instead of anything else, so I became a senior guy for a year as a lieutenant. Can you imagine living in a room with Ed Meckenbauer, Kevin McManus, and a gentleman that you don't know, Galen Kramer, and being a senior man? That's more fun than you should ever be entitled to.
Ron Bliss and Ed Meckenbauer are two of the former POWs featured in the new documentary, Return with Honor. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Physix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at visx.com. And from Princeton University Press, publishers of A Life of Birds by David Attenborough, a companion to the 10-part TV series airing now on PBS, in bookstores or on the web at pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, former POWs Ron Bliss and Ed Meckenbauer tell us about their release from captivity and return to home and families. They're both featured in the new documentary, Return with Honor.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Ron Bliss and Ed Meckenbeyer. They were each fighter pilots flying missions over North Vietnam when they were shot down and held as prisoners of war for about 6 years. Bliss and Meckenbeyer are among the former POWs interviewed in the new documentary Return with Honor. They were interrogated and tortured repeatedly. What could you do mentally, psychologically, to just keep reminding yourself of what you believed in and why you were going to hold out and why you were going to do everything to not reveal information that you had, to not rat out anybody else? Your mind must get so disoriented and so disturbed by repeated torture and by all the other deprivation that you were going through. So what do you do to remind yourself of who you are and what you stand for?
You want to take a shot at that, Ed, first?
Well, I think it's as much a matter of the fact that Ron alluded to it earlier. As long as you're not alone, now you have a reason. If it's only to hold the other guy's hand when he's in trouble and have somebody there when you get in trouble. And you'd be amazed at the richness of what's in your own mind when you don't have a television, a magazine, or a newspaper to distract you. When you can start thinking about the things that you've learned, the dreams that you've had, the creativity that of the human spirit is really unbridled. And then sometimes, you know, you just spend time with somebody else just telling stories and fantasizing and things like that. So there's a lot in you that when you take away all of the convenient diversions that you have and you just have to rely upon yourself and maybe one or two other people, you can, interesting word, entertain yourself, keep your mind busy, and maybe not the most productively, but certainly enough to keep yourself oriented and sane.
Ron Bliss, did you have any form of religion to fall back on, prayer that you could use, or poems that you could recite to yourself, songs that you would sing to yourself, things that would kind of give you a richer inner life while deprived of your outer life?
Well, yes, and yes, all of the above. Everybody had his own religious belief, and mine changed a little bit up there. I found out that my classical approach, as I was taught and practiced here in life, needed to be adapted to a different form of the world than I had ever seen or heard about. But in terms of you have to realize that we were all highly trained, highly motivated people, and something which is very difficult to explain is camaraderie, because it doesn't exist in the civilian life. People have been deprived. They've been deprived mightily, because when you have trained with people running over the North Road, for example, at the Air Force Academy, throwing up because you can't go any farther, and somebody falls down and you are trained that two of you will pick him up and a third will pick up his rifle because you don't leave anybody or anything behind. Now, you don't find that in the civilian world, but that is a feeling among men and women that is, you can't put a price tag on that. We are blessed to have found that.
Tell me more about how your sense of your religion changed.
I came out of a classic Baptist upbringing. And, of course, I was a regular church attender until I got to the Air Force Academy. And when chapel was compulsory, it's a natural reaction of a young lad. You react. And I didn't appreciate some of that. They've since changed the rules. They're doing it very well now. But I got to the point where I realized that, look, life is neither fair nor unfair. Life just is. And you can't blame life or anything. You can blame yourself if you don't step up to the plate and meet life head on. So what I prayed for was not the easy way out, because I knew there wasn't one. And perhaps we shouldn't even deserve one. But I said, dear God, just give me the strength to do what I need to do and give me a hint about what I ought to do. And then I'll take it from there. And if I fail, have mercy.
Ed Meckenbeyer, did you have a religion to help sustain you? And did that sense of religion change?
It didn't change. I was a Catholic. I still am a Catholic. I don't know that I appreciate the Catholic Church the way it is today, because I rather appreciate the way it was before I went to Vietnam. And like Ron's group, you know, it was interesting. I was one of 66 people stationed in Europe who volunteered, in quotation marks, to go to Vietnam. Of those 66, statistically skewed probably higher than the average, I was the 33rd to get shot down. Of those 33, four survived. So I always kind of took the attitude that God got me through that for some reason. There was some reason I didn't stay with that airplane a second and a half longer and smash into the ground with it. And so I just appreciated the fact that I had survived, and I was clever enough to believe I hadn't done it on my own. And so I just came away from it more with a better appreciation for why I, as an individual, am here.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Ronald Bliss and Ed Meckenbier, and they're both American pilots who were held prisoner of war in Vietnam for over 6 years. They were released in 1973. They're two of the former prisoners of war who are interviewed in the film Return with Honor. How were you told that you were going to be released? Ed Meckenbier, do you want to start?
Well, for the first time ever, we were back in the Hanoi Hilton. For the first time ever, the Vietnamese got us all outside and allowed us to stand in what would pass for a fairly decent military formation. And they read to us the protocols concerning the release of POWs that had been agreed to. Now, interestingly enough, this was 5 days and maximum amount of time after the signing that they were allowed to tell us. And so they went right to the 11th hour, the 59th minute, and all the rest of that to tell us. And you know, 2 or 3 days before, they knew the war was over, obviously, but they kept telling us it was going to last forever. So at the last minute, they drug us all outside, and they read the protocols and generically told us how we would go home in four equal groups, approximating the withdrawal of each quarter of the American troops remaining in South Vietnam. And as it says in the movie, interestingly enough, there wasn't any, you know, ripping off your shirts and jumping up and down and yelling and screaming. It was all kind of, okay, yeah, I'll believe it when it happens. And everybody just kind of quietly went back into their cells.
Ron Bliss, what was the sweetest moment for you after your release or after being told that you would be released?
The sweetest moment. It would have to be a combination of two things. Number one, arriving at Clark Air Base and seeing the wonderful welcome of John Q. Citizen, who was there in the Philippines on the air base, going into an air-conditioned hospital room where we had a soft bed, which I couldn't sleep on. We'd been sleeping on concrete and wood for years, with clean sheets and a pitcher of water with ice cubes in it. I mean, we're talking first class now, right? But the biggest thrill, I think, was at midnight that first night when I finally got to call home and talk to Charlene for the first time. And
your wife?
My wife, Charlene. It had been pretty close to 7 years by the time I'd had the chance to talk to her yet. And I had a son that was not quite 2 months old when I left. And 30 days after I returned to the States, he turned 7. So I was looking forward to seeing him. He's quite a young lad. He's a good man. How sweet it is.
Ed Meckenbier, what about you?
I think Ron hit it right on the head. I mean, you find out what's really important in life, and it's those with whom you are blessed to share life. And so every stage along the way, the people in the hospital were wonderful. All the people who greeted us in the Philippines and at Travis and in San Francisco and the wonderful people here in Dayton, Ohio. When I got back here, it was 21 degrees below zero that night when we got back at 1:30 in the morning. And there were hundreds of people out there in that flight line. And, you know, those are all, it's not one moment. It was just a cascade of joy. And like Ron says, getting back with the family, I mean, that really kind of put the punctuation mark on it and says, okay, now I'm ready to start the rest of my life because I've got the things that I think and hold close and are cherishable. They're back together now.
I'm wondering if there were moments after you were united with your families, if you felt surprising alienation because you had changed so much maybe from the over 6 years as prisoners of war. And I don't know if your wives had changed much since, you know, in the intervening years. But in some ways, you must have felt like a different person, put back into a life that you hadn't been in for so long. So did you feel confusing, conflicting things and a certain degree of alienation from your own life and your own family?
Alienation's probably too strong of a word, but you have to realize that we were gone out of the country for well over six and a half years, and the country went through such a rapid change, it almost fell apart on its own, and society changed. I don't mean this lightly. It sounds that way. We were up there so long, we virtually missed the miniskirt. And people change every day. You'll be a little bit different person tomorrow than you are today. That's the nature of the beast. Now, you multiply that by 6.5 years or so, and you've got remarkable changes. Alienated? No. Careful? Yes. We were careful about everything. You felt around. You groped. You came in very lightly to see who you had, what you had, and let them know who you were. And it didn't happen in a day. It took a while.
And in the movie, Everett Alvarez talks about a shield, an insulation shield around us. And I think some of us still have that to some extent. And it's not that we're standoffish or anything else like that. It's just that, that there are some very private things that some of them perhaps too horrible to share with your family. Some of them are just things that only guys like Ron and I and Kevin McManus and Joe Milligan and all the rest of the guys would ever really truly appreciate. Otherwise, you get yourself into a situation where you're trying to read a dictionary of words to explain something that just isn't understandable.
Did you try to hold back a lot of what you experienced from your family?
I just basically said, okay, today's the first day of the rest of my life. I mean, I have never sat down and tried to recreate a diary of what it was like over there. I mean, it's, as far as I was concerned, it's gone. You know, the spilt milk is already soured, so get on with the rest of your life.
So was doing the movie Return with Honor and talking in detail about what had happened to you something you hadn't much done before?
Hadn't done much before.
I think a lot of us have done something on that order before, but I think they got deeper than anyone else has in this project. I told Freedom Ock and Terry S. Anders, I said, look,
the directors,
you may have two-thirds of what really counts up there, and that is light years ahead of what anybody else has ever done or will do. And as Ed said, the other third is just so private, so personal, that nobody will ever hear it.
Rambliss, you have to leave us now because you are in Texas and the studio time there has run out. I wish we had more time to talk, but we have to
end. Thank you very much.
Part of the conversation.
I've enjoyed it, Terry.
I've enjoyed it, too, and I want to thank you very much. And, I wish you good luck and good health, and thank you for sharing part of your story with us.
We'll be standing when the mountains fall. Ed, take it from here, and I've enjoyed talking to you again. Terry, thank you very much. So long.
Ed Meckenbier, if it's okay with you, I'd like to just continue speaking for the next few minutes.
Press on.
And before I do, let me just say that Ronald Bliss, who we just spoke with, was held prisoner of war in North Vietnam for over 6 years. He's now a lawyer specializing in intellectual property and technology. He's the former Texas Aerospace Commissioner. And both Ronald Bliss and Ed Meckenbier are interviewed in the documentary Return with Honor about American fighter pilots who were held prisoner of war in Vietnam. Let's take a short break here, and then Ed Meckenbier will talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ed Meckenbier, and he is one of the American fighter pilots interviewed in the new movie Return with Honor, a documentary about fighter pilots who were shot down during the war in Vietnam and held prisoner of war. He was a prisoner of war for over 6 years. What were your thoughts about the anti-war movement when you came home after being a prisoner of war for over 6 years?
Well, it's amazing. It didn't change. I mean, it's what a wonderful country to where people can express their views like that. They didn't always agree with the way that they did it, particularly some of the more influential people in the arts and in the media and in politics. But, you know, you can't come away from living in a communist society as we did and see the utter repression of privacy and, you know, free thinking and not come back and say, well, you know, different strokes for different folks. And at least, you know, if it's a lousy system, it's still the best one in the world, as Winston Churchill said. So I didn't come away with any personal animosity towards anybody who might have walked up to me and says, you know, I was anti-war. In fact, I went to Kent State University and addressed the student body there a couple times.
What'd you talk about?
The war in Vietnam, mm-hmm. and my experiences. Had a very warm reception.
Now, did you find that people in the anti-war movement really wanted to know what happened to you, or did you feel that they didn't want to hear it because it would contradict some of their views?
I have never had anyone, with the possible exception of Jane Fonda, I have never had anyone ever try to personally embarrass me or call into question my integrity for having been in that war. And I have talked to a lot of people who had different opinion on our involvement in that war than I did.
But Jane Fonda challenged you?
Oh, no. Jane Fonda still maintains that she was right and the world was wrong and all the rest of that stuff. I mean, she's just an absolute embarrassment, I think, to this country.
I'm wondering if
subtle opinion.
when you got home and you were adjusting to being home again, did you want or were you given any counseling? Did you feel that was necessary?
I don't know that I wanted it. Whether or not I needed it is probably still an open question in many people's mind. But by and large, there were preconceived ideas about what we would be. And I hope we didn't match any of them, you know, because we weren't prone to commit suicide. We weren't latent homosexuals. We weren't indecisive. We weren't committing suicide at an inordinate rate. And there was one other one. I forgot what the fifth one was. But they had kind of told our families certain characteristics and watch us. And when we went down for a recurrency flying down at Randolph Field in Texas, they wouldn't let us fly solo by ourselves because, you know, we might not quite be right in an airplane. So I think, you know, we felt like we were not as weird or as odd for the experience as a lot of people professionally thought we should be or were.
You know, as you point out in the film, when you're a fighter pilot and you're there in the sky, you feel invincible, and in a way you need to feel invincible.
Mm-hmm.
But after you've been shot down and held prisoner and tortured, when you're back in the sky, can you still feel invincible?
Absolutely. I mean, I came home and I flew fighters for another 17 years. And I'm still the world's best fighter pilot, even though I'm now flying a cargo airplane. but it's an attitude. I mean, I'm sitting here in a control room with a fellow who, if he doesn't think he's as good at what he does as anybody in this world, you know, he's not ever going to be as good as even he can be. You aren't going to be as good a television or radio personality if you don't really have some faith in your own ability. It's not to say that you have to become an egomaniac or say, I know everything there is to know, there's nothing to know. But you have to have a high opinion, a high regard of your own personal capability to go out there and match wits, to match skills and talents against other people day in and day out.
My guest is Ed Meckenbeyer, one of the former POWs interviewed in the documentary Return with Honor. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ed Meckenbeyer, one of the former POWs featured in the film Return with Honor, about American fighter pilots who were shot down over Vietnam, captured, and held as prisoners of war. In the movie, the men who are interviewed, the former prisoners of war, are really quite stoic in describing the torture and the solitary confinement and so on. And the place where they really, where some of them really break down, is in talking about going home and seeing their family again. Why do you think that is?
Well, because you're training. You know, the 4 years at the Air Force Academy, the 3 survival schools, just the rigor of becoming an Air Force fighter pilot prepares you professionally for the call to arms, so to say. And there are all those other things. And in the movie there, Leroy Stutt says, you know, the Air Force had seen fit to send me off to these survival schools, and I escaped and evaded for 5 seconds. You know, you're prepared for a certain element. The only time in the movie I ever cry is at the end, when the Air Force Academy choir is singing, "Lord, Guard, and Guide the Men Who Fly." That's an emotional side. I mean, you can build yourself up against, you know, a particular frontal assault or thrust, a particular thought. But when you get down to the idea, again, go back to something we talked about earlier with Ron, you know, when you start getting into the soft underbelly, the emotion, the pride, the camaraderie, you know, then there's always a little chink in the armor there. There's always room for that, no matter how stoic you can be.
Is there anything that you would like to teach fighter pilots that you learned during your captivity that you wish that you had been taught?
Not just fighter pilots, everybody. People look at us and they say, gee, I could never do that. How did you do that? Oh, I could never. That's not the message. The story is anybody could do it. We're all products of a society. Don't look at me and say, gee, you're a hero. I could never do that. You know, you would, you could, because I didn't receive, some special training, but if they'd been in the same situation, they'd had the same training I did. And then the other thing is you just tell people ahead of time, be aware of the fact that you've got a wingman. Somebody packed your parachute. Somebody put gas in your airplane. You know, don't be as arrogant as you might think you have to be the world's greatest fighter pilot. The world's greatest fighter pilot, Ed Meckenbeyer, goes around and shakes a lot of people's hands and says, thanks for packing my parachute.
Do you still have the after effects of injuries that you suffered when you were tortured?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, like a lot of guys, I mean, I've got, I had a broken back, and, you know, I sleep about 2 hours of whack at night, get up, walk around a little bit. I still have the dreams. I still got a lot of aches and pains. But, you know, the other part of that is I'm a whole lot better off than the 54,000 guys who died. I'm a whole lot better off than people who lost arms and legs and limbs, and some of the young kids who saw things that they weren't emotionally prepared to see. So I can live with my aches and pains. I'm doing pretty good.
It must be really difficult to heal when you're not given any medical attention.
Well, again, that's a aspect of the human body. I mean, I think, you know, man was created by God in a pretty unsophisticated environment, and I'm sure they broke arms and legs and had poison. I mean, the death rate might have been higher. But the human body is a pretty remarkable piece of engineering. And given time, it may not be as comfortable, and, you know, it may be a little more painful, but the human body, you can relocate your own shoulders. We all prove that. I mean, I spent a week in footstocks, which is probably a good deal because my back was broken, so I couldn't move for a week. I survived that. I had an abscess, you know. Talk about things that you remember in the Philippines. I mean, I'd had an abscess and had a toothache for about 3 years. The right side of my face was puffed out about 2 inches for 3 years. You know, body didn't shut down. It kept going.
You mentioned before that you still have dreams about Vietnam. Have they changed, or is it the same kind of dream as you used to have?
Yeah, there's a classic dream, and whether no matter what it is, there's a lot of dreams, you know, where you're being physically abused. A nice way to say tortured. But some of them are really kind of funny in that you have to get back. You're sitting at a baseball game in Cincinnati or Houston or Dallas or something like that, and you look at your watch and say, gee, I got to get back. I got to get back before the guards find out I'm missing. So that's probably the most recurrent theme. You know, it's like going back to the wound. You got a certain comfort factor there.
How much contact do you have with the other men who you knew during the period of captivity?
quite a bit, really. Like Ron Bliss, he and I are classmates from the Air Force Academy, and by backseater, Kevin McManus lives over in Washington, and he and I are still very close. I mean, I spent 4 years with him. I could ruin his marriage.
But I mean, you wouldn't do a thing like that.
No, because he could ruin me. So you have that. And then, I'm still in the Air Force Reserve. I'm privileged to be a Major General in the Air Force Reserve. And so, as a part-timer, I get to travel a little bit and stay close to these guys. We have two reunions every 5 years. So we have reunions on the 5, 10, 15, 20, 25-year point. And we're finding that there are a lot of mini reunions in between, guys geographically close together. So it's a pretty close-knit group in that regard.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. And I wish you the best. Thank you.
Thank you very much for giving us this opportunity to tell our story.
Ed Meckenbeier is one of the former POWs interviewed in the documentary Return with Honor. The film is now playing in several cities and will open in more cities over the next few months. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Kathy Wolfe. Research assistance from Sam Adams. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, call 877-21-FRESH. That's 877-213-7374. Fresh Air is also available online at audible.com/freshair. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Little Brown & Company, publishers of The Miracle of Castel di Sangro by Joe McGinnis, in hardcover wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Robert Kotlowitz discusses his World War II memoir. He was in college when he was drafted into the infantry. He was one of only three men in his platoon who survived an ill-advised assault on the Germans. He had to play dead for 12 hours. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.